I'm here with Derek Jeffries, who is a professor of religion. And tell me, Derek, again, I'm sorry, cut. Are you religion and philosophy?
That's right, Dominic.
Okay, religion and philosophy at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. And we're talking about his new book. And Derek, we should explain at the outset that there's a difference between prison and jail and that your book focuses on the latter. What is the difference, and why did you specifically examine dignity in the context of jails?
Right. Well, it's really important in this book to make the distinction between prisons and jails. In the American penal system, we have this distinction. Jails are usually county institutions, and they're for holding people for short term, maybe a year or two, or usually pre-trial detainees. And so a lot of the people who are in jail have not been convicted. They're legally innocent of a crime. A prison is a state institution or a federal institution, and everybody in the prison has been convicted. So this is an important distinction in the American penal system. And I decided to focus on dignity. I've written in the past about topics like torture and solitary confinement. I've written books on those topics. And dignity is an important moral idiom, particularly in the 20th century, particularly Catholic thought. And I don't feel that we've focused enough of it in debates about mass incarceration. So that was the reason I chose to discuss it.
You sort of got you gave the listeners a sense of what differentiates a jail from a prison. Maybe you could characterize the population of those incarcerated in jails in terms of their offenses, which I guess typically are low level. How's this come about? And is there any idea of the number of people in jails at any given time?
Well, we have an enormous jail system in the United States. Anywhere from 11 to 12 million people go through the jails annually. So that's just an incredible number of people. Any given day, there are about 700,000 people incarcerated in jails. You'll find in a jail some people who are very dangerous. I mean, they just have to be separated. They've committed acts of violence. And you'll find some people who won't show up for their trials. And that was, in fact, the original purpose of the jail, to deal with that population. But I think what you'll find if you go into a jail, and I spent time in a number of different jails, is you'll find a very large percentage of the population that's pre-trial. So it's 60 to 80%, depending on the jail. And these people are waiting for trial. And a lot of them aren't dangerous. They're people who can't afford the bail that the court has decided they need to pay. So a lot of them are very poor. You also find another population of people suffering from mental illness. This is something that I encountered a great deal in Chicago in the Cook County Jail. So you'll find a large number of the population, percentage of the population in jails fall into those two categories, either very poor people, as you said, facing low-level charges, or people suffering from mental illness.
What do you ascribe the situation to in terms of how jails have kind of come to serve as mental health facilities in this way? What's led to this situation, and what are some of the consequences for the mentally ill who find themselves jailed?
Well, it's a really long story in terms of how we ended up here. The usual story is we had deinstitutionalization in the 1960s, and that released a lot of people into society who weren't prepared to live in society. I think that's too simplistic a story. There's no question that the closing of the large mental institutions did lead a lot of people to go into the jail system, but one did not automatically lead to the other.
So in your book, you take a fairly comprehensive look at jails as proxies for mental health facilities. What's led to this situation, and what are some of the consequences for the mentally ill who find themselves jailed?
Well, I think a lot of people attribute this to what they call deinstitutionalization, that is the closing of our large mental institutions. And I think there's some truth to that, but I think the story is a lot more complex than that. We really closed a lot of these mental institutions in the 1960s, and there really was a gap then between mass incarceration and deinstitutionalization. But we do have to remember that in the United States, we have a long history of incarcerating people in mental institutions. There's a statistic I like to give. It's in the book that in 1955, we incarcerated over 559,000 people in state mental institutions. And so we would have these populations that we would lock up back in the 40s and 50s. And once we got rid of the mental institutions, some of these people had nowhere to go. And once we started building up prisons and jails in the 1980s and 90s, the jail then became a place for people who had of last resort. And the picture isn't a pretty one. I think most people would agree that we have a crisis. Sheriffs that I talk to talk about this all the time. Because a jail is not a place for someone with mental illness. People often don't get their medication. They can wait sometimes up to a week to get their medication. Sometimes they don't get any medication. And they are often taken advantage of by other inmates. They're often confused. And this leads some people, sadly, to commit suicide. There's a pretty high rate of suicide among people in our jail system. So this is really a crisis, a major crisis, and it's one of the messages of this book that we need to do something about this.
Would you say the crisis extends to the situation now in terms of how jails have become holding centers for undocumented immigrants, often some of whom are seeking asylum? What are the unique situations that these detainees face?
Well, this started in the Obama administration. The Obama administration deported a lot of people. And what occurred in the Obama administration is these private prison companies began to build jails. I would call them jails because they're temporary holding cells. How to classify them is a bit complex, but they do serve the functions of jails. And now under the Trump administration, this has become huge. I mean, extraordinary numbers of people incarcerated in these places. And for the inmates in these private prisons, things are particularly bad because they don't have a lot of rights. They don't have any recourse. If something terrible happens, they can't protest. They're afraid of protesting. And the conditions in these jails are really bad. The sanitary conditions, I feature one of these jails in my book, and the sanitary conditions are just unimaginable. So this is a real disaster. This is, in some ways, the next front in thinking about the jail system, I think.
And I'm not sure if you get into this so much in your book, but it seems that I've been seeing statistics about this recently in terms of these centers when they're used for undocumented immigrants, that some of the people detained there, tends to be a high rate of suicide. They tend to be subject to things like sexual abuse. Is that the case? Have you found this as well?
I don't feature that in the book, but that's unquestionably the case, especially sexual abuse. I mean, this is a general problem in the American jail system. People don't realize. We make jokes about this, and we really shouldn't, because a lot of people are sexually assaulted, particularly juveniles. And in these facilities that we're talking about, there is a pretty high rate of sexual abuse, staff abuse, and the kind of psychological issues that you're talking about. I mean, if people are coming from another country, they have a lot to deal with to begin with, and they don't speak the language perhaps very well. And the psychological impact on them is quite significant. So I would say that a lot of the problems we find in any jail are compounded in these immigrant facilities.
You know, in addition, I think, to some of these the conditions in terms of the physical surroundings, vulnerability to sexual abuse, you do spend time in your book talking about jails sometimes being used for really revenue generating purposes, you know, to the extent that some municipal facilities are accepting inmates from other municipalities. But even the inmates themselves as individual people are used, you know, in terms of, you know, I think of having fees and fines levied upon them, for example. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, and I'll give you a couple of examples of this. I mean, it's all over the country, but here in Wisconsin, I teach in jails here in Wisconsin. I teach religion and philosophy to inmates. And here in Wisconsin, we can charge, some jails charge inmates $20 a day. And so if they're there for a very long time, when they get out, even if they're not convicted, when they get out of the jail, they're presented with a bill. And a lot of people are just too poor to pay that. And it really destroys their credit rating. So that's just their per diem charge. But then all kinds of other things, DNA testing, lawyers' fees, all kinds of things like that. And as you said, some municipalities, in the book I talk about Ferguson, which everybody knows about. But in Ferguson, one of the reasons there were riots there is because people were treated this way. They were arrested and charged and then released and arrested and charged. And the federal government came out with a study describing how Ferguson raised money in this fashion. And this is not uncommon, particularly in the South as well. So inmates are often used, they're often rented out to other, when you have overcrowding, sometimes they're rented out. They're literally sent to other counties because the county can't afford to keep them there. So this is a significant difficulty.
I want to, if you could, and you use the term rented out. Is this sort of a term of art in the industry? Is this how people in the industry actually refer to it? Or can you explain the use of that term a little bit?
Yeah, that was my term. It's not, but if you have overcrowding in a county jail, and we have this problem in Wisconsin, the inmates will be sent out to another jail. And the other jail, if it doesn't have that many inmates, will accept them and charge the other county for housing the inmate. I, in fact, was just talking to an inmate who was in one of my classes, and I came back 2 weeks ago, and he wasn't there. And because overcrowding is a problem at the jail where I was teaching, he was sent to another jail. So jails can take in inmates from other counties. Sometimes they can take in convicted prisoners from prisons. And it kind of depends on the population of the jail. If it's overcrowded, it won't do this. If there's space, it will accept inmates from other counties. Pennsylvania, this is Philadelphia, this is pretty common.
Derek, one of the sort of interesting parts of your book, to me at least, is you kind of, you do take sort of a long look at the history of incarceration and you sort of look back on to this, I think, this age where we think that things might have been better in terms of policy, in terms of the idea of thinking of how to rehabilitate people who went through the system. But in fact, you say it maybe wasn't as rosy or as progressive or as successful as we tend to believe. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, we largely, except for in juvenile justice, I think in terms of adult justice, we've given up on the ideal of rehabilitation. This really has been the case for the last couple of decades. We don't believe in that anymore, and our adult correction facilities more or less reflect that. Inmates help themselves or change almost despite the system, in my view. But what I wanted to say in the book is that sometimes there's a contrast. Sometimes people who are trying to change our criminal justice system want to harken back to an age of the 1950s or the 1960s when we actually cared about rehabilitation. We gave official obeisance to that. We said, yes, that is our official purpose. So there's no question that the level of official rhetoric, some prisons were committed to that. I don't think this is true in the South, by the way. If you look at Texas, if you think at Arkansas, Georgia, Florida, I think if you look at those penal systems, there's some very good books on this. A fantastic book by a guy named Robert Perkinson called Texas Tough, looking at that system. And I don't think rehabilitation was the goal of those systems at all. So we have to think about where we're talking about. Then we might say, well, the North, northern prisons were a lot better. There's this myth that the northern prisons were actually committed to rehabilitation. But again, we have to distinguish between official rhetoric and what actually happened to the inmates. And many times the officials weren't that interested in that. And I just wanted to add one other thing to this. I think at a philosophical level, we should ask ourselves whether or not rehabilitation really is what we should aim at. Many people, when they talk about criminal justice reform, they want to, let's go back to a system of rehabilitation. But in the 1960s and 70s, there was a critique on the American left, which I think was quite strong, that maybe rehabilitation shouldn't be the goal of punishment at all. It was coercive. It demanded certain things of the inmates. It was racially unjust. And I take a lot to heart that critique. I'm just not sure that the old emphasis on rehabilitation was something we want to revive at all. So that's really why it's important to understand the history, because we have to ask people today who are trying to change the system, what do you want to change it into?
Right. You know, Derek, maybe we could turn a little bit now to, I guess, what is sort of the heart of your book. and the actual concept of dignity. And dignity is something that many people might think that someone who has been jailed has either forfeited or might not have deserved in the first place. Can you talk about how we think of the concept of dignity in these contexts? As you yourself put the question in your book, why should we believe that jail inmates have dignity at all?
Yes, the kind of dignity I'm talking about is very important in Catholic thought and papal encyclicals, many other documents, is what's called inherent dignity. And that means that a person has value, and that value is not something they're given to them by others, their parents, society. They retain that value simply because they're a person. Philosophers use this phrase, qua person. And that is a very important kind of dignity. It's not the only kind of dignity, as I pointed out in the book, but it's a kind of dignity that became very important in the 20th century. And some people don't like it. Some people reject it. I discuss some of those people in the book. But I think it's really important when you're talking about a penal system to think about inherent dignity. So what this means is that people can't lose that dignity even if they commit a terrible crime. They still have this value. And what's also important to me, particularly because I teach inmates and have been doing so for a long time, is that people often feel like they've lost their dignity. And it's a very painful thing for somebody who's, we have a maximum security prison here in Green Bay, and we have a lot of young men who go into that prison at 20, 22, and face a life without the possibility of parole. And these people feel like they have lost all their dignity. If you believe in inherent dignity, that can't be the case either. They can't lose it. They can't do something to lose it. So that's a kind of view of dignity that I'm defending in this book.
I'm not sure you get to it in your book, Derek, but what about sometimes we also talk about dignity in terms of the jailers themselves. Is that something that people should think about too?
Definitely. And I really should say here, I make this point in the book, I'm not intending to demonize corrections officers. I've seen and talked to people who have done some pretty awful things to inmates. And there is a great, good amount, not a great deal, but a good amount of staff violence in our penal system. And people just don't pay attention to it. But I'm not intending to demonize the officers at all. And I have spent a good amount of time. I worship in the chapel at our maximum security prison. And I spent a good amount of time with the officers there. And yes, they also have to worry about their view of the world, their sense of value. And working in a prison can take a serious toll on some of these people. So I do think that's an important factor to consider as well. I don't talk about it as much in the book, but that's something that I'm quite concerned about.
I want to read you a quote from the book now, and I'll ask you to speak to it. Mass incarceration is a moral scandal, you write, but responding to it requires more than outrage and assertions about injustice. Instead, we need careful analysis of ideas of justice, dignity, and human rights that have always been a matter of dispute. Can you explain what this analysis might constitute or how it could be carried out?
We're getting a lot of good work from historians, particularly younger historians, about mass incarceration. There, Heather Ann Thompson, who wrote this fine book on Attica. She's not a younger scholar, but she has a number of students who are writing really good stuff. But what I find, I'm a philosopher, and this is an interdisciplinary book. What I find with some of these historians is that they don't interrogate these questions about what exactly are human rights? Why do we have them? What exactly is dignity? And these are very controversial topics in political philosophy and philosophy in general. And so I'd like to see a richer account of these. Why is it so bad that we have 2.6 million people incarcerated, 2.2 million people incarcerated in our country and millions under parole? Why is it such a bad thing? I think it is, but I'd like to investigate that. And so the main point in this book, the main topic is dignity. I don't look so much at some of those other topics to really get a sense of what we mean by dignity. But human rights would be another thing to think about. What exactly are they? what kind of beings have rights. There's a lot of discussion about this in political philosophy. So I think the mass incarceration discussion could be enhanced, could be enriched if we think about these topics a little more deeply.
Toward the end of your book, you kind of get around to sort of trying to see a way ahead. What are the obstacles to improving conditions of jails? Are there long-term solutions, or do you see only main short-term responses to what's essentially an emergency situation? And I'll just, you know, I'm here in New York, for instance, and some politicians who consider themselves, say, proper progressives are eager to shut down the Rikers Island jail, which is notorious probably not only here, but nationwide. But the unanswered question is, what then? Does this get to the root issue of the importance of human dignity in this age of mass incarceration?
Well, I try to do a couple things in this book. There is an emergency situation, and I don't think we should allow larger goals to get in the way of trying to simply help people. We discussed earlier the problem of mental illness. We have to stop staff violence. We have to improve medical care. These are things that we can do right now, and I think it's important. I spent some time with Sheriff Dart at Cook County Jail. He's really trying to do some positive things. He's gotten the population down. When I visited that jail, there's about 10,000 people. It's now down to about 6,000. And I interviewed him, and I really think he's sincere in trying to make some positive changes. So there are some short-term things, remedies that we can do immediately. But at the end of the book, I wanted to step back and ask, but what is the ultimate goal of all this? And I think you find two schools of thought. You find people who say they're in favor of criminal justice reform. And what they mean, you'll find progressives even saying this, Ocasio-Cortez in New York and others. And what they mean usually is to make the jails clean and fair and get rid of some of the problems, reduce the population, and keep the public safe. So that's one goal, is those people. And then there's a more radical wing that says, no, the jail is a failed institution. And we need to stop some people from committing violence against others. That's important. But the jail has never been a good institution, and it's very unlikely that we're going to be able to change that. And I didn't know where I stood on this, to be honest, Dominic, but when you write a book, you receive readers, particularly at university presses. And I had a very good reader. Sometimes the readers aren't good, sometimes they are. But I had a very good reader who was, I believe, a criminologist, a very good criminologist. And this person really pushed me. And he said, you got to take a stance. I wrote a book on solitary confinement. And so I spent a lot of time writing about these things. And he really pushed me and said, you kind of seem like somebody in the second camp. And he was right. So at the end of the book, I take the stand. It's kind of a more radical stance by saying that the jail is just a failed institution. One point about New York, Rikers Island, I've read the report talking about Rikers Island. It would be good to close that place down. It's an awful place. It's too big. I agree with that entirely. But it's not clear to me that what's going to replace it is necessarily going to be better. They want to open up these in the different boroughs. And I'm from New York City, and the Brooklyn House of Detention has a long history of abusing inmates. And so it's not clear to me that this is going to be better. I would hope so, but I think people are a little quick to get on that bandwagon.
I think so too. And I, you know, if I could just even editorialize a little bit, I live in the shadow of the Brooklyn Detention Center. And it seems that even as I do think it's a worthy goal, shutting Rikers down, but it seems to me that as envisioned currently, it's going to be sort of just recreating the problem in five different boroughs instead of one just centralized location.
Exactly. Exactly.
Derek, for the audience, could you just say the title of your book?
Yes. America's Jails, The Search for Human Dignity in an Age of Mass Incarceration.
Thank you for being here. And I do recommend the book to those who are listening. It's well-researched, well-written, and very thoughtful. Derek, thank you for being here.
Dominic, thank you so much.